Welcome to All Systems Ergo, a human factors and ergonomics podcast delving into the fascinating world of healthcare. My name is Fran Ives and I am a chartered human factors specialist. I'm naturally curious about people, and throughout this series I want to explore different areas of healthcare human factors and the people who work in this diverse discipline.
I'm delighted to welcome Lauren Morgan, a chartered human factors specialist with a wealth of experience in healthcare. Following her undergraduate degree and PhD in human factors, Lauren spent a number of years working at the Nuffield Department of Surgical Sciences at the University of Oxford before setting up her own consultancy, Morgan Human Systems. And if that's not enough, she's also just become a trustee of the Clinical Human Factors Group. Now, there are a multitude of reasons for me wanting to talk to Lauren today, but one of the areas I'd really like to explore is the breadth of human factors work that Lauren has undertaken. She's got experience in hospital design, investigations, teaching, and that is barely scratching the surface. So, Lauren, welcome today, and I'm looking forward to delving a little bit deeper into your work, your thoughts, and your experiences.
Thank you, Fran. It's such a privilege to be here today. I'm really excited to have the chat that we're going to have. Thank you.
Brilliant. I want to take you right back to the very beginning, if we can, and go back to your ergonomics undergraduate degree at Loughborough University. I completed the same degree a few years before you, and it was only recently that somebody said to me, you know, how on earth did you discover that degree at the age of 18 when you were looking for university courses? How did you find it and how did you decide that you wanted to do it? Which was a question that I've been asked so many times over the course of my career. So I was really curious to ask you that question and really wonder where that motivation for studying ergonomics came from.
Oh, that's interesting, actually, because I didn't. I went to study engineering, actually. I was doing aeronautical engineering at Loughborough, and I did a year to become an aeronautical engineer. And that's what I thought I always wanted to do. But what I wanted to do was to design things. And I thought that's what engineers did. And to some extent, they do. But I was after I'd been doing engineering for a little while, I decided it didn't quite give me the design aspect that I wanted to do. And it was quite micro. We were focusing on sort of the materials makeup of different screws, and that wasn't really keeping my attention. So I was clearing out my room in halls, actually, and I was going to run. I was running to be social secretary of the halls because I'm a bit of a social butterfly and I like that stuff. And I went to tell the current social secretary. I was like, I'm really sorry. I'm not going to run for social secretary. And he goes, can I ask why? And I said, well, I've decided that I don't want to do engineering anymore, so I'm leaving university. He said, oh, I did that. I said, what? He goes, yeah, I did a year of engineering and I decided I was going to do ergonomics because I wanted to do more about the design of things. And I was like, oh, that's cool, because that's kind of what I want to do. And he goes, well, why don't you have my ergonomics textbooks and have a read through them and see if they're what you want to do? And I did. And that's what I wanted to do. And then I said, oh, I didn't have any more chat with him. And I don't remember who that is, who that individual is, because I'd love to go back to them and tell them that they completely shifted the whole. So if someone out there is listening and knows who that was, that would be amazing. And when I went back, I went and I said, well, I'm not going back to Loughborough because, like, you know, I've kind of gone there and I've failed because I saw it as a failure of that's what I was going to do. And I dropped out and all of that. And then when I looked it up and Loughborough was the top course to do it, I was like, oh, damn it. So I'm going to have to go. So I went back to Loughborough and the rest is history in that lovely wavy top building full of asbestos. I'm sure it was then and all of that. It was just wonderful days, wasn't it? I feel so sad that there's not undergrads anymore in ergonomics. I'd love to change that.
It's quite a story, actually. And I'm glad that I asked the question because I had no idea that that was how you came to ergonomics. And as you say, that ergonomics degree doesn't exist anymore, and I find that really sad as well, because personally I absolutely loved my time at university, and I very much went into that degree thinking, I think this is what I want to do. Looking at the topics that were on my timetable, it looked like a really good diverse mix of topics, but didn't really know, because you never know. And that's proven by your story of starting off doing engineering. You never quite know how it's going to turn out and whether it's going to be a subject that captures you and takes you through and ends up being your career. So I've always felt very lucky to have done that degree. And to then be able to come out of that, I did a year in industry, which gave me experience in automotive. So I came out after those 4 years feeling, well, I think you come out as a graduate thinking you know everything and actually you know nothing. But I had that really good broad base for ergonomics and human factors, which could then take me into any different industry. And I feel sad now that we don't have that, because we have graduates very much coming through some of the brilliant master's courses. But they don't have those years of sort of grounding that we had. And interestingly, I was at a Chartered Institute event on Tuesday. It was a rail event. And in walked Marie Sinclair, who I'm sure you remember from your
days.
That's
amazing.
Yeah. Yes. And it was just wonderful to see one of my old lecturers. And honestly, to see the passion that he still has.
I still remember Murray Sinclair talking about Internet of Things, but like, oh, I don't know, probably 15 years ago at a conference, and saying, we as human factors, well, it was ergonomics then, wasn't it? And, you know, that's the degree we did and whatever. And we call it human factors now. But, you know, we ergonomists need to get into this Internet of Things, because, you know, it's all about design of interaction of systems. And we're all like, oh, Murray, you know, whatever. And look where we are. He's absolutely right. I mean, lots of people have made lots of different suggestions that I would say equally as cool. But yeah, lovely to see Murray still engaging in the topic. And I hope that when I'm that age, that I'm still sort of popping up around the subject. And I think that's what ergonomics does for people, you know, actually, it makes them interested in that topic and captures you for life, because it does have that diversity of application and diversity of focus that means that you can continue to evolve and stay interested in it. So yeah, here's to Murray, and here's to many more like him.
Absolutely. And you say there that, you know, you can apply it to all sorts of different areas. Now, you're very much in the healthcare world. Was that a conscious decision coming out of university to go into healthcare, or was it a sort of a happy coincidence of things that led you there?
No, it's a really conscious decision, actually, Fran. My dad fell off a roof and cracked his back in quite a few places, and his chest in a few places at the same time. And, you know, he's fine, touch wood, or whatever we can do to not witch that situation, and is a very active farmer at the moment, and long may he continue to be that. But whilst after he'd fallen off that roof, he was in Robert Jones and Agnes Hunt, the orthopaedic centre, not far from where I live now, and I was there whilst doing my undergrad and seeing what healthcare looked like, and I just thought, I've got to have a piece of this. And hit that, along with Ken Eason. I don't know if you remember Ken Eason as well. We can have reminiscing about Loughborough days. Ken Eason had come in and he'd done a lecture about Vin Christine and done a proper breakdown of that. And I, those two things, I remember standing in my parents' lambing shed, because they're farmers, telling them really enthusiastically about this Vin Christine lecture that Kenny's, I must have been such a geek looking back. But those two things really made that it had to be healthcare for me. But at that time, when I was leaving university, there wasn't a job in hospitals or in healthcare that kind of employed HF people. So it's research was my kind of way into it, hence the joining Oxford and becoming a researcher in that.
And just give me a flavour of some of the highlights of your time at Oxford, the sorts of projects and work you were involved in.
I mean, the highlights, Oxford is such a wonderful place to be, because you're just surrounded by so many opportunities to work with so many amazing people. And I really miss that aspect of it. In terms of the research side of it, I think the first project that I went to do was an observational study. And although I hated it when I first started, because it meant that very early starts and going and standing in operating theatres and standing in operating theatres day after day after day, or standing on a ward day after day after day. But what that gave me was a real in-depth understanding of what those hospital environments were like across a range of sites as well. So it wasn't just, you know, the teaching hospital in Oxford, but across a range of different types of hospital settings. And I think, you know, if anyone is getting into healthcare, I'd really urge them to go and spend some time not thinking that you can apply any of your human factors stuff yet, just understanding healthcare.
Yes.
Because that bit gave me so much, and I still pull on experiences from being in those operating theatres. So that's kind of the first bit. The second aspect that I think taught me a lot was our first, and we did a couple of technology development and spin out things from Oxford. But the first one of those was a vital signs tool, and the team that we were able to assemble, you know, we still message each other to talk about, you know, the good old days of when we were doing that Project Send, it was called at the time. And we pulled together and developed something that I'm really proud of that had human factors at its core. Mm-hmm. And for me, that really changed how that organization at that time saw human factors. So rather than seeing it as just simulation or just, you know, and simulation's amazing. It can do such fantastic things. But for that organization, the realization that actually applied to design of clinical systems, it can do so much more as well. So those are probably, actually, there's a third highlight as well. There's a lot. I mean, I was there for 14 years, so there's going to be a few, isn't there? The third one is probably the work that we were able to do with the GMC. So when the GMC came and we spoke to them about investigation, and then I spent 6 months working with them, about developing their investigation practices and in the fitness to practice directorate, that was amazing to be able to impact such a big organization in that way. So yeah, lots of different experiences, some trickier, you know, being a young female academic having maternity leave, because I had three children while I was at Oxford, and you know, they had fantastic maternity leave, that was amazing. But in that kind of writing paper grant funding cycle, it's not designed to support women who step out of the workplace for 6 or 12 months, because your name isn't, you're no longer the first author on the paper, or you're, you know, so you don't end up with the funding grants, and you know, it's kind of publish or perish in that kind of academic world. So I found that really challenging, actually. And I think we've got much better with the advent of Athena Swan and the kind of incentives to have women around the table in those areas. But if you look at that department, the Nuffield Department of Surgery that I was working in, and other comparable departments, you'll still see a massive weighting towards men, particularly in the younger age ranges of those departments. And that's, you know, something that we really need to look at going forward.
And how can we change that? Not I'm expecting you to single-handedly change that, Lauren.
I love a magic wand, and I'll do that. I think a recognition, I would love academia to realise that there are other ways of influencing and sharing information that's not in academic papers. So I think academic papers are really important. But have I influenced more practice through the conversations that I've been able to have compared to the academic papers that I've published? 100%, 1000% more. So I think, you know, we need a focus on the range of different things that you need to be an academic, a researcher, and in essence an influencer, because that's what you need to be as a working in research in that area. You're trying to bring people along with you, understand that science and that side of things. And it's not all about academic papers, but equally I think to write an academic paper takes time, and that's really difficult when you're in that cycle. And, you know, I was in the cycle where I had a baby. I was off for a year. I came back. I was there for a short period of time. And then I was pregnant. And the minute that I got pregnant, everyone was like, oh, she's going on maternity leave again. And it was that countdown to when I was on maternity leave. And people were really supportive of me. As I said, there was fantastic maternity leave. And many, many people aren't afforded that same opportunity. And I, you know, I'm not complaining about that at all. But it definitely made it more difficult to get that funding. So I think that recognition of what that's going to do to your career, and I, how you support it, I think we could do more actually to support the academic writing side of things. So I remember chatting to Charles Vincent about this actually, and in his research group, he told me about how they'd employed people whose job it was to support people in writing, to coach them in it, to help them do it. And when you look at how prolific that group was in publishing, well, it makes sense, doesn't it? I've got a file on my computer that's full of unpublished academic papers that didn't make it through the final push to get published because it's so difficult. So I think if you had someone by your side coaching you with that and helping you with that, I think I'd probably have at least twice, if not three times, the amount of papers published than I do. So yeah, that would be my first thing. Employ someone who helps all people in academia publish papers, but it would particularly help, I think, those women who are stepping in and stepping out in that maternity leave cycle.
That's really interesting about that role to support people. So I think I've never been in academia. And so for me, yes, I have had my name on papers, never been the lead author, because it feels quite daunting, actually. Not if you're not in academia, where do you start to sit down and write that academic paper? And, you know, you see education institutions sort of churning them out and you think, oh, crikey, I don't really know where to start with that. So I do wonder, actually, if we were able to support some of the embedded HF specialists across the country with that, we would be able to produce a whole host of really good literature.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, I've seen you talk about projects that you've been involved in and you explain them in a scientific way because you explain what it was that you set out to do, how you approached it, what your methodologies were, what your results were and what you've learned. Like that's what that academic paper is. Yeah. And so it's translated in a way. What's really sad about academia is you translate the plain speech, which people can understand, into something that is more acceptable to the journals. And I think that's really problematic. I do really like, by the way, that the ergonomics journal allow you to submit your paper your way. I think that's really helpful. It's a massive barrier to publishing when you have to go through all of the formatting for that specific journal. So I think what they've done there with that does make the barrier to entry much lower. And I think that's full credit to them for doing that.
That's brilliant. And I'm now going to go away and think about what we can do to support other embedded HF specialists. But that's a conversation for another day. One of the things that you mentioned was when you left university, you know, there wasn't a job there as an embedded HF specialist in healthcare, which is why you went into academia. And over the years, we have started to see the number of embedded HF roles increase, which is brilliant. But it's not an easy task recruiting to these roles. So what do you think we can do to try and ensure that we're filling these roles with suitable people and also that we're adequately supporting the people who do accept these roles?
I think that's like the $1 million question at the moment, Fran. Like, I think there's so many, you know, we're both complex systems practitioners. That's what we do. We look at complex systems, and this is a really complex systems problem. You know, actually, we started off talking about the loss of the degree program. I think the undergraduate degree program, I think that's massive. The idea that you can learn the breadth of stuff that's needed to go and practice human factors in a hospital in a master's, I think is a big ask. And the idea that you do that in some of these masters are not face-to-face taught. In fact, I don't think any of them are face-to-face taught at the moment, which I really struggle with, I have to admit. Being an educator myself at the moment, I'm doing an awful lot of education. I can see the massive difference between live talk content on Teams and face-to-face content. And it's night and day. And that most of the courses, a lot of their teaching is done through online e-learning, you know, self-directed study. That's not what, you know, HF is a problem-based topic. It's a science which requires you to poke and prod something, apply different methodologies, experiment. Like, it's a really researchy based discipline. And I think the idea that you can learn that from a book chapter and an academic paper and a video just doesn't cut it for me. Mm. So I think we're setting people up to fail. You know, the discipline itself is about helping people succeed. Mm. And the way that we're training them is setting them up to fail. Like, the irony is right there. Mm. In terms of the support, I think what Laura Pickup and others are doing at the moment, part of that network, to support individuals who are embedded and share practice and stuff like that, I think that's really, really beneficial. But, you know, lots of my work at the moment is in implementing the new patient safety incident response framework. And I know you spoke to Tracy about her work, and she's doing amazing work in that area. Mm. What that framework asks you to do is to say, look at your capacity for investigation in that case in your organisation and decide what you're going to do in response to that. And I think we need to do that from a HF point of view with our HF embedded HF practitioners. You know, one person, what is one person realistically going to be able to achieve within an organization, and then scale back the ambition ever so slightly? Because I think certainly where I see people that have been recruited in, it's usually where you've got enthusiasts, really hard working enthusiasts within that organization. So if I think about some of the ones I know, you know, surgeons, anaesthetists, who have really lent into this, really lent into this topic, and recruited and developed a business case to recruit those people in. So rightly, they want to see a load of improvement out of having that individual, and the trust wants to see that, you know, suddenly we've created a new role, we want to see the return on our investment. And that's a really big ask. So I think, yeah, the work that others are doing to build a network is going to help support, but also a bit of scaffolding around of what is realistic for a HF person to do within a trust, the kind of things that they can get involved in, I think is key. But to not set them up to fail, they need to have the right skills and experience to get in there in the first place. And I think at the moment, those individuals are really hard to find because of the way that at the moment we're doing our training.
Mm. And I've seen an awful lot of people come in through the MSc route, and what they often have is a great deal of experience in healthcare because they've come from another profession, which in many ways is brilliant, because, you know, you talked right about the work you did at the very start of your career, spending hours and days standing in theatre and on the wards, which is hugely beneficial, because if you don't come from a healthcare background, going into a hospital and standing in an operating theatre or a ward or any kind of clinical area is really daunting, really daunting. And I think, you know, I quickly forgot how daunting that was until I had a placement student who was doing an ergonomics degree at Loughborough. And she came to my trust for a year. And I remember first few days, you know, I was taking her to various places, and there were two things that made me think, crikey, I have to remember what it's like to walk into a hospital, not as a patient, but as a member of staff, not knowing how things work. An alarm went off in our department, and we were a clinical department. So, of course, the natural response was everyone got up to go and see where the alarm was and to see what needed to happen, how we could assist in any way. And I remember the look of shock on her face. It was kind of, what the heck is happening here? You know, all these people just kind of moving. And I took her into theatre as well. And again, you know, I'm not clinical, but I've been into theatre many, many, many times and sort of know the drill. And looking at her made me sort of remember, actually, this is a really alien environment if you're not used to it. And to throw somebody in there, if they're a sole practitioner without any healthcare experience, is really hard. So you have the advantage of these people coming in having that healthcare experience, but that can also be a disadvantage in a way, I think, because they're coming with preconceived ideas about how things should work. Whereas I've always felt I can go in and ask the seemingly obvious questions, because I always say, well, I'm not from a clinical background, and it kind of almost gives me permission. But I do think it's a lot to ask.
I think that it, like, this is no critique of anyone that's doing those roles, by the way, because like
we have some fabulous people doing those
absolutely
roles.
Absolutely amazing. And we need people to be doing those roles. Like, we've got to grow this, but it's a risk, because those individuals, you know, speaking to people in those roles at the moment and speaking to people who are doing masters at the moment, are just a bit disappointed. And what we risk is that we lose the science. We lose the appetite for the science, because everyone goes, well, you did the HF masters, you're the HF specialist, and we haven't, you know, what do you know? What are you bringing, anything different to the table? And I can, you know, I can see that. And so I think we really need to support those individuals who have taken their own personal time to go and work in a subject, and also not judge the success of or the value of a whole profession on a few individuals and their ability to make impact across the whole of the NHS in the next 12 months. So it's a kind of please wait and see. Please let's see if we can grow this as a science and a discipline. And and arming those individuals who are in place with a network, with support, with ideas of things that they can get their teeth into. And I think you're right in terms of the publishing aspect of that, because that, you know, healthcare is very evidence-based, you know, of course it is. So we need the publishing side of it. And I think I'm only aware of HF practitioners, but I might be wrong, but I'm only aware of them at the moment being employed in hospitals. And of course, that's only one bit of our health service, actually. And, you know, if we think about the massive changes that need to happen and will happen in primary care, in mental health, you know, in many ways, the need is much greater across these other areas of the health service. But it's hard enough in a hospital where you're surrounded by some people who want you there in the first place. So, you know, it's going to be really hard for other sectors. I do think PSURF and the way that's been rolled out at the moment, and the focus, how much human factors is essential to it, is going to raise a lot of awareness. And I'm seeing a really big increase in the request for human factors support in the trust that I work alongside. So I suspect the demand will increase, which I think, you know, can only be positive.
So we've talked a lot about the challenges of sole practitioners and the support that could be given to those who are new to the profession in order to, you know, help them to establish, to grow and to develop. And we are in a position where very few NHS trusts have got more than one qualified HF specialist, although I am pleased to say that is growing. Do you have any thoughts or examples of the sorts of projects that a single practitioner could get involved in within a hospital, or any areas where you feel they could make the most impact?
Oh, good question. I think first and foremost, use the allies that are in that hospital. So there wouldn't be a HF person if there wasn't already allies for HF within that organisation. So I think joining up with them, finding out what is it that, where do they see the opportunities? Because they'll have probably built a business case around it anyway. So that's the first thing, but that's broad. I guess I could give sort of five key areas where I think I've had the biggest impact and where I found most, I guess, easier to join in with the hospital's practice. So one would be around procurement. Whether that's a big piece of kit like an EPR system or whether that's a smaller piece of kit, but getting involved in supporting the procurement process from the clinical end. So, you know, the reps are bringing in three pieces of kit, user test it, that kind of thing. Two, around training needs analysis. So often training in healthcare, you know, there's that old adage, isn't there? See one, do one, teach one. And which sometimes is true. And so what do people really need to know about that system of work when they're coming in? So, you know, you've got new doctors, new nurses coming in. Agency use is probably at the highest in the NHS that it ever has been, and even higher in other areas of care, so social care and mental health care. So What do people need to know about coming into that space? And can you nudge the induction process or the training process to support that? Three, I think, governance. So at the moment, we've got this massive change of PCIF coming into the NHS. So that requires staff to have an understanding of human factors in its application. And so really supporting that, really leaning into that, getting involved in those learning responses, getting involved in those investigations. Four, documentation design. I think that knowing how much documentation is currently done within a hospital. So some of it will be done on paper, some of it will be done on a computer. But using our fundamental understanding of usability to help shift that documentation into a more usable format that considers the whole task that's going on, not just the documentation task. And five, a bit of HF training, actually. You know, although we talked about the sheep dip approach earlier, that kind of being involved in awareness training around human factors in trust, I think, is really important. So we've got the patient safety syllabus that trust will be rolling out, and I'd definitely look to see how much your trust, if you're involved in a trust, has rolled out the patient safety syllabus, because that'll tell you how much the awareness of staff is on human factors. But looking at supporting that understanding, so systems human factors is absolutely fundamental to embedding a just culture within a trust. If you understand how systems of work happen, then that understanding helps support a just culture. So the more you can do around that, and I don't mean full days of human factors training, you know, in my local trust, I work with the fetal monitoring team and I do a sort of 10-minute introduction to systems as part of their fetal monitoring day. It's that little bit of support, a little bit of HF that's just fed into different training programs that I think really helps that embedding and understanding. And then you'll probably develop a contact through that who'll go, we've got this, you know, the one of the pieces of work that I've got involved in is the procurement of new CTG machines. I wouldn't have been involved in that if I wasn't doing the fetal monitoring training. Yeah. So it's that stuff. And I think once you're there for a few months, people get to know how useful you are. And the challenge won't be, what do you do? The challenge will be, what do you not do, actually? Yeah. that becomes the bigger question. And if anyone has an answer of how to say, no, I'm not going to get involved in that, then they have to... answers on a postcard, please, because that's really, really difficult for a people pleaser like I am, and like I think you are too, Fran. So I think those are probably my top five.
And that's really nice to actually be able to give people listening that sense of, these are the things that I could maybe explore within my own trust, because we've talked quite a lot about the challenges, but actually there is so much that sole practitioners can do. I mean, I was a sole practitioner for a long time. And like you, Lauren, I found it really hard to not get involved in stuff, because there were so many areas. And you're absolutely right. As you build up relationships with people in departments and they begin to understand what you do, often through conversations or through being involved in a project with yourself, it then sparks further ideas and further requests for things, which is just a joy to see, because you can appreciate that they're asking you for support because they understand what support you can give. It can be hard to say no, because, you know, I get quite excited at seeing people come to me with all of these requests. I think that's amazing. The challenge is to say no. There is never a challenge of you know, how on earth can I help these people? There is always a way.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's those networks, you know, the frontline clinicians are often our home, aren't they? You know, they're our best friends within the organisation. But also it's those others. If I think about some of my greatest allies that have sat alongside human factors, they've been in the IT teams. They've been in the coding teams. Actually, one of my best friends from Oxford, who helped in a load of work, was in the clinical coding team. They're in those procurement teams. They're in those improvement teams, like that's been on a bit of a journey within human factors. So it'd be a big difference between organizations of the size of that improvement team. But that would be my point six, actually, get involved in whatever improvement projects they're doing. But I think that, yeah, finding those other groups and building allies within the organization. So I started with that point about using the allies that are already there, but through that network, kind of building the allies around human factors that you've got within your organization. So yeah, I think, and the last thing actually that more latterly I've become more aware of is look at your NEDs on your trust board. What are their backgrounds? So often there's a NED with a background in the military. Well, they're going to have an understanding of human factors. You might have a NED with an understanding of aviation. They're going to understand human factors. So what are those, you know, of course, some of our executive directors might have an understanding. I still remember walking into one medical director's office and he had Drift to Failure by Sydney Decker on the desk. And I thought, this is going to go well.
Yeah.
I don't know if that was just a really well-placed book and he was really hoping for a good moment there, but maybe he picks a book off his shelf for whoever's coming to visit. That's part of his thing. But yeah, kudos to him for doing that. But thinking about where the allyship is in those really senior members in the organization can be really important. So if I think about, again, my local trust, we've got an aviation or a military, but aviation military member of in our executive team, and he's a fantastic champion for the work that we're doing, and it's things like that that really, really help.
That's a really good tip. So there's some really practical pieces of advice there for people, which I think will be incredibly useful. And I know you've done a lot of human factors teaching over your career. And just reflecting back on that, you know, thinking about the different sessions that you've done, the different groups of staff that you've taught, where do you think you've made the most impact and, you know, really given some value to the training rather than it just being a sheep dip exercise?
I mean, obviously my training is always high impact, Fran.
Of course it is. You know, that's in no doubt, Lauren.
I genuinely try really, really hard to only deliver training when I think that it's not sheep dip. I don't sign up to the sheep dip approach. But of course, some training has more impact than others. And actually, if I reflect on one of the most recent training things, so way back in the day, I got a call from the medical director and the associate director for quality of North Carlisle Integrated Care Trust. And they said, we'd like you to come and talk to us about investigations. And we went up and we did some training in SEEPs. This is way before HSIB, way before any of that work was happening anywhere. And they've carried on and done loads of work around that. Really impressive organisation in that way, very much to the credit of that that associate director, Ruth O'Dowd, who's also just become a trustee of the Clinical Human Factors Group, actually. So, you know, she's grown in her interest of the science and explored it. And that's exactly the kind of individuals that we need alongside those HF practitioners. But so that's, you know, if I usually judge my time frames in terms of children, and I hadn't had a child at that point. So that's pre-2014. So it's a long time ago now. And I was with that trust, with the same people, well, the same leadership team, a couple of weeks ago, and they'd invited me to come and speak to their IT team. And the IT team were quite reluctant to be in the room with me, I think it's fair to say. They're a bit like, what is she going to tell us about IT? And I can honestly say, you know, it's one of the biggest kicks, isn't it, being an educator when the light bulbs go off. In the room, it's like, you know, it's one of those things that sounds really cheesy, but it's just really cool to be able to stand in front of a group of other professional adults who are all amazing at their job, who all have their own skills and experience, and still be able to make a light bulb go off. That's really, really cool. And I stood there, and the first hour they were still a bit like, what are you rambling on about? And after about an hour and a half, they got it, and they got it big style. And so they are just about to buy, just going into the procurement phase of their of an electronic patient record system. And they've decided to completely change the way in which they're going to procure their electronic patient record based on the human factors training, because they're going to look at, you know, real use case testing, clinical use cases that go in front of these suppliers. They're going to evaluate usability against the ISO standard. They're going to, you know, reconsider testing a range of users. They're going to run it in simulation. You know, it's just phenomenal. Of course, they're still going to do all the normal procurement, which one's cheapest and all the rest of it, but they're going to have this whole load of data alongside that to tell them which is the most usable system and which has got the lowest clinical risk of implementation. So I think that for me is where it's at now. It's about actually not just raising awareness, because I think we've done a really good job of raising awareness of what human factors is, but it's showing the real benefit in particular clinical areas. And that for me is probably the one that springs to mind, because it's not that long ago, but had a real impact in terms of that team.
And I think you can really appreciate that impact, because you know what those people have taken away from that education and how they can directly apply it to their work. And that's often the thing that I struggle with. You know, yes, we can raise awareness, we can give that education, but what is that individual going to actually do with that knowledge? How are they going to change the way that they work? And if we can't, or if I can't really see what impact that education knowledge is going to give, then I think that leads to the question of, should we be doing that type of training in that particular way?
Yeah.
So for me to hear that story about how quickly that team can see the relevance of human factors and understand really brilliantly how they can apply it to their work is a brilliant example of where human factors training and information and knowledge is going to be applied. And I would guess that their own knowledge is going to build and build and build as they go through this process. And I suppose the hope is that it just then becomes part of the next system that they procure and the one after that. And then it just becomes business as usual.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, training's different, isn't it, in different formats. You know, this wasn't chalk and talk. This was a simulated user test in the room. And we put, you know, we used different tools to illustrate what they could do. So it's kind of, rather than human factors training, it was more of a workshop. How could you possibly apply this to what your problem is at the moment with me coaching along the way, you know? But yes, that can still be badged under education. But I think when you're doing that, when you're rowing in alongside, when you're solving the problem with them in the room in a workshop kind of way, that's when you add the value, because you're not you're doing that translation piece for them. I could have taught them and given some lovely glossy slides about the standard and talked about the theory of user testing and how valuable testing a usability of a system is and what clinical risk would be part of it. But when we ran it, you know, and that would have been lovely and much easier for me, actually.
Yeah.
But the value of sitting in a room and getting one of the volunteers to do a live user test of creating something in front of us and them seeing her struggle and seeing that reflected in the data, that was super, super valuable to them. They could really, you know, the translation piece was done. They were already like, right, this is what we're going to do and this is how we're going to use it. And it wasn't just in that new procurement bit. They were like off thinking about other ways in which they can apply it. Clearly, they need more support, right? So it makes good business sense for me. You know, you mentioned I run my own consultancy. You know, lovely to be invited to do education. But actually, it makes so much more sense if you can engage a team in wanting human factors, because then I can support them in the future, me or someone else. You know, I'm not precious about that. There is more than enough to go around, but it's creating the appetite for that support in different places.
And maybe they'll give us all something to think about in terms of, you know, how we view education. You know, I've often said that some of the best training I've done in human factors is actually conversations with people, you know, and not actually, as you say, that talk and chalk. And I think specifically applying human factors to something that they are interested in, something that's relevant to them, is often the key thing, because then that gets them hooked in. You mentioned your own consultancy, and that gives you the ability to work with lots of different organisations doing lots of different things. And I know you've done some work looking at new hospital design. And I think that's a really, really interesting area, but it can be an area that's sometimes quite difficult to get into. So can you tell me a little bit about that piece of work and actually how you got to being involved in the first place?
This is where I think that consultancies working together is really powerful, and us seeing ourselves as a network of HF people who support each other. So Ben Tipney and that MedLed company had been working with West Suffolk Hospitals, supporting them with their HF faculty, doing some fantastic work with them. And they were talking about their new hospital design, and because he'd raised the awareness of human factors across that trust, they asked, you know, for support in that new hospital project. And he said, do you know what, that's not 100% of my skill set at the moment, but I know someone that I could call who might help. And so full credit to Ben there for doing that. I think, you know, I did send him a nice hamper as a thank you, and I perhaps should have sent more, because it's honestly one of the most interesting projects that I've ever worked on. I think areas where I'm able to apply this stuff to design, whether it's design of a hospital, an IT program, a clinical service, that's where I think I get the most joy. But so how I got a seat at the table was through a recommendation. How I kept a seat at the table, which I think is perhaps the bigger question, because I think, you know, when I first, the first piece of work was, well, the second piece of work was about five times bigger than the first. So that tells you how much they suddenly wanted from human factors. And I think that's, you know, full credit to that team for leaning into it. I think they're a fantastic team at West Suffolk doing that new hospital build. And they really liked the way that human factors was able to bridge the gap between what the clinicians were asking for and what the architects were hearing. Because the clinicians were able to articulate that they wanted an office, and the architects are hearing, we need an office, but we don't have space for one. And what human factors is able to do is go, let's have a look at the tasks that are done in this area, and let's understand the space that's needed for those tasks. And so when you look at a junior doctor on a ward and the kind of things that they need to do and how available they need to be to the staff, it's quite easy to describe the need for an office space in a clinical area. But that's much easier for the project to handle than just a group of clinicians who feel like all they're saying is, you know, doing a bit of a land grab. And they're really not, you know, they're saying what they need, because what they know what they need, because they're skilled practitioners having done it over years. But it was that translation piece, and human factors is often a translation piece, isn't it? You know, you're often sat in different groups helping that little bit between where you're going, I think we need this, and bringing a tool out of your back pocket to try and explain it in systematic ways. And the other thing that we were able to do was diffuse arguments, you know, like not because people were being precious or anything like that, but just because they weren't, it wasn't possible to articulate their needs in ways that didn't come across better than sort of saying, well, my wants outrank your wants. And that's never cool. And no one wants to be in that scenario, do they? So, you know, by taking a use case scenario, a use case methodology, and saying, no, let's create use cases for these clinical environments. Let's take pharmacy, for example. One of your use cases is going to be receiving medications in, as well as dispensing them. You know, you have to receive deliveries. Yeah. So let's map how that's going to work in your department. And now let's map dispensing. And now let's map the prep of chemo drugs. And now let's map, you know, a patient coming to collect their own prescription to take home. And once you've looked at all of those things, actually, it all comes out in the wash, and you can see what needs to happen in the environment. But it's really that layering of those HF tools of task analysis, link analysis, bit of observational work, cognitive walkthroughs, all of that stuff that actually you don't need to apply like you're going to write it up in an academic paper, but you need to know what you're doing and be able to take shortcuts in the methodologies when you know you can. Yeah. And I think that's the bit that gave them lots of value, and they got lots out of it. And we made massive changes to the design, but in really positive ways. You know, the feedback was really, really good out of that.
Oh, brilliant. I got quite excited when you were talking about all of the practical work that you were doing, all that mapping. I thought, yes, that is proper roll your sleeves up human factors.
Exactly. You can see why the minute you asked the question and you got on to new hostel design, you know, my face just lights up, because it is genuinely like, I got asked, you mentioned about the trustee position for the Clinical Human Factors Group. And in the interview for that role, they asked me what I'm most proud of at the moment. And I said, the thing is, I judge what I'm most proud of by the thing that's going to make the biggest difference. And I said, actually, being involved in the design of a new hostel, if by doing this work, I've created a ward that is safer for children to be cared for the next 20, 30, 50, 100 years, how cool is that? Like gives me a kick. And my kids, because that hospital is a good drive away from me, you know, 3 hours plus across the country. My children are really sad if I have to be away overnight, as lots of mums can attest to. And I explained to them the one day, I was like, look, I cannot wait to go and show you this hospital. And honestly, you should have seen the look on their faces. They were like, Mum, I think we'd rather go to Centre Parks, not go on a tour of a hospital. I was like, trust me, when that hospital opens, we are going, because it's such a big part of me now. So, might have to go to the Centre Parks that's next door at the same time as a sweetener. It's a bit of a thing for me, you know. We went to Australia. I've been to Australia twice to visit my brother who lives in Perth, and each time we've had to visit a hospital, because I have to see it's in me, this desire to want to understand hospitals, get them better. It's cool. I had a real fangirl moment, I've got to tell you. So I was at an architecture conference, a healthcare architecture conference, and we were talking, and this one girl was there, and she was from Australia, and I said, oh, there's an amazing hospital in Australia. I said, the Fiona Stanley and the Children's Hospital in Perth. I said, both are really, really cool. And she said, would you like to meet the lead architect? And I nearly fainted. So they went and she took a picture of me in between the lead architects of these two different hospitals. And I was honestly so starstruck, because it's just, they've really designed their hospitals to make it better for staff and for patients. And that's what we need to get in the new hospital program. We really do. Because they last such a long time and have such a massive impact on people's lives when you have to get near them. So, I'll sharp about hospitals, new hospitals now.
One of the things, though, that I really love when I talk to other human factors specialists is to see their eyes light up and to hear the passion in their voices. And, you know, I don't really speak to many people from other professions. I don't know whether we have such passionate people in aeronautical engineering or in other areas, but it's definitely something that I see amongst human factors professionals, that excitement and that passion. And that's exactly what I saw just then. And that makes me really, really pleased that we have people in our profession that respond like that. How do you find working for an NHS trust, but in that external consultancy capacity? Are there any challenges to that, as well as any benefits?
I think it's actually where I'm happiest. And I think I've always kind of been in that role, that kind of area, because when we were working alongside Oxford University Hospitals NHS Trust, we were working alongside them as researchers. Yeah. You know, I was employed by the university, not employed by the hospital. I think sometimes the culture in NHS organisations can be really tricky. And I think that I got a phone call from someone a couple of years ago who said, can you stop sticking your head up above the parapet? Because we kind of like it that you're around here. And that told me that for that individual in that organization, you didn't speak up or you got, you know, moved sideways or lost. And I think that, you know, unfortunately, some organizations do still have a culture like that. And that can make it really challenging when you're employed there. So I think by being an external person, you can say things, but you've got this kind of protective cloak around you that, it, you know, yes, they're not, they cannot hire you again to do work, but actually that's all they can do. And I think that's really beneficial. Having said that, whenever I work alongside an NH Trust, I like to try and get in as much as I can to support. You know, some of my best friends now are NHS staff that I've worked alongside in hospital trusts. So I kind of want my cake and eat it, if that's okay. And at the moment, that seems to be working. I think also the trusts, there's something about that externality that makes, that gives you license to say stuff and means that some people listen in different ways. Okay. So I was with University Hospitals Birmingham, who you know really well, and with Justin and Louisa, the governance leads there, and like two fantastic individuals in terms of their knowledge and skills and experience in it. And they'd asked me to come and speak to the board about PCIF, and I spoke to the board. Both of those could have spoken to the board and said exactly the things that I'd said, but there was something about me being an outsider that meant that the board listened in a different way. And so I can compliment the people on the inside, say the same things that what they're saying and back them up. And I think that works really well. And I, to be honest, I just love the freedom that it gives me, that if I've got an organization, I've got one at the moment that's not a good fit for me, I don't enjoy, it doesn't, you know, when I see their name in the calendar, I don't feel a warm glow in my heart, and I can walk away from that organization. You know, I don't have to, it's not a big commitment. So I think, you know, each individuals work best in different organizations, don't they? Loads of individuals will like working with that particular organization. It's just not for me. So I think I have great freedom in that, and I really value that. But yeah, it's a joy doing, it's such a privilege, isn't it, to support NHS staff. It really, really is. And I know that when I stand in front of people and I'm being introduced to an organization and I say that, and people are like, God, why would you say that? Like, you don't believe. And I'm like, no, I genuinely do. You know, I genuinely believe this is such a gift to be able to come in, support someone in the work that they do, help them do that and get a better outcome for their staff and for their patients. That you can't really ask for much more, to be honest.
No, absolutely. I completely agree. I've got two final questions for you. So what skills or qualities do you see in other people that you really admire?
Oh, the ability to podcast from you. I think you're a good interviewer. What do I see in other people that I admire? Oh, that's a good one. I think those that can write. I'd love to be able to write more. I think the way that Steve Shorrock translates his thoughts into words and puts them down on paper in a way that makes the science open to others. I know you've had Todd Conklin mentioned on your pod before. The way that he translates what he's thinking about into words that allow us to explore it and understand it. So I think those people that are out there kind of exploring the science, translating it, putting it into ways that different people can access it, I think that's really, really wonderful. I think those that are good at writing books, you know, Catherine Sutcliffe, amazing, you know, such amazing writing, and those that she works with. I think Pascal Carrion and the work that she's done, that's phenomenal in terms of her ability to translate. So I think, yeah, it's those that are able to take the idea, shape it in a way that makes it palatable to others, that makes the job for someone like me so much easier because I've got these fantastic resources that I can kind of share. You know, not everyone loves a book. Some people like a pod, some people like a blog post, some people like a journal article. So if I've got people that are in those different areas who I trust and can throw to, that's for me. And I'd love to be able to do a bit more of all of that stuff, but I'm not great at it.
And my final question to you is, who in the HF world do you really admire? Which are those names that you think are?
Good question. I admire all of those individuals, but if you were to ask me to pick a HF person who I really admire, I'd pick Sarah Sharples, actually, because she's such, you know, I remember being at one of the earlier ergonomics and human factors conferences, and seeing her up on stage, and she was president at around the age that I am now, and so, you know, that was just phenomenal. And for a young I was young at the time, for a young researcher looking up and seeing a woman take a position of prestige, because it had been pretty much men while I'd been while I'd been an undergrad and while I'd been following the discipline, and to see what she's gone on to do, you know, be vice chancellor, be, you know, everything that she's done, be current chair of the transport, is it the science group? Oh god, I should remember what that is. Scientific advisory committee, thank you. I think, you know, that's just super aspirational. And, you know, I met with her last year at the conference because she came, didn't she? And she got an award at the conference and gave a speech. And I was chatting to her about how she'd really inspired me. And I could see that she was a bit like, you know, as you would be, a little bit awkward about someone saying that to you. But she was so encouraging. And even in that moment, she was like, God, let's get a cuppa, you know, come and have a chat. Let me map. Let's look at your career and see what else we can do. Like, so generous with her time. So I think her, but I'd also like to give a little shout out as well to my PhD supervisor, Neil Mansfield, because he's just got a super exciting position as well in Nottingham. And he just instilled in me such fundamental research principles that I honestly lean on every single day in my job. So I think, you know, he's just one of those people who's just good at what he does, just really, really good at the science. And I think that, so those guys, we were really lucky, weren't we, in Loughborough, to be surrounded by these individuals. And, you know, Sarah was at Nottingham. She wasn't a million miles away. And she's kind of, it was just that a little bit of a golden time there, I think. And I feel really sad that people don't get to experience that anymore. But maybe we can get back there. We could start a campaign.
There are two people, those two people you mentioned are people that I hold in very high regard as well. So it's really nice for me to hear you talk about them and talk about the impact that they've had on your life as well. So two brilliant people. Thank you for that, Lauren. And thank you for your time today and sharing all of the wonderful experiences that you've had and all of the sorts of projects, but also sharing that passion as well that really shines through. And we're lucky to have people such as yourselves in healthcare human factors. So thank you.
Oh, thank you. Can I, before you close, can I just add, though, because you asked me two people that that I look up to. And of course, you know, there's all of our wonderful HF community, that including you're at the forefront of that in terms of, you know, practicing in human factors. But, you know, like, actually, none of us in healthcare could do the job that we're able to do without the clinicians and the patients that we get to work alongside. So I'd just like to say that, you know, like, actually, if you were to ask me the people that have the most influence on me day to day, it's those families that I meet, or those clinical staff that are working alongside me. They're the real, like, inspiration, I suppose, at the moment. So I can't, there's too many to name them all, and if I started naming one, then others would get really cross. But let me just say, all of you guys, all of you patient advocates and clinicians and staff that work in healthcare who are non-clinical, which are by no means any less equal of and deserving of praise than the rest. So those are the real champions as well. So I couldn't leave without thanking them. Sorry to drag on.
No, I think that's a wonderful way to finish. So thank you.